In the end, her voice had been overruled. Even Druid had sided against her. It had been the money, of course. The department was always short of funds to conduct its less spectacular work. When it came to some grandiose scheme like moving the entire temple of Abu Simbel to a new site above the floodwaters of the Aswan High Dam, then the nations of the world had poured tens of millions of dollars in. However, the day-to-day operational expenses of the department attracted no such support. Their half share of the royalties from River God, for that was the book's title, had financed almost a year of research and exploration. But that was not enough to allay Royan's personal misgivings. The author had taken too many liberties with the facts contained in the scrolls, and had embroidered historical characters with personalities and foibles for which there was not the least evidence. In particular, she felt he had portrayed Taita, the ancient scribe, as a braggart and a vainglorious poseur. She resented that. In fairness, she was forced to concede that the author's brief had been to make the facts as palatable and readable as possible to a wide lay public, and she reluctantly agreed that he had succeeded in doing so. However, all her scientific training revolted against such a popularization of something so unique and wonderful. But she sighed and put these thoughts out of her head. The damage was done, and thinking about it only served to irritate her. She turned her thoughts to more pressing problems. If she was to do the lecture that the prof had invited her to deliver, then she would need her slides, and these were still at her office in the museum. While she was still working out the best way to get hold of them without fetching them in person, exhaustion overtook her, and she fell asleep, still fully clothed, on top of the bed. In the end, the solution to her problem was simplicity itself. She merely phoned the administration office and arranged for them to collect the box of slides from her office and send it out to the airport in a taxi with one of the secretaries. When the secretary handed them over to her at the British Airways check-in desk, he told her, "The police were at the museum when we opened this morning. They wanted to speak to you, doctor." Obviously, they had traced the registration of the wrecked Renault. She was pleased that she had her British passport. If she had tried to leave the country with her Egyptian papers, she might have run into delays. The police would probably have placed a restriction order on all passport control points. As it was, she passed through the checkpoint with no difficulty, and once she was in the final departure lounge, she went to the newsstand and studied the array of newspapers. All the local newspapers carried the story of the bombing of her car, and most of them had resurrected the story of Druid's murder and linked the two events. One of them hinted at fundamentalist religious involvement. El Arab had a front-page photograph of herself and Druid, which had been taken the previous month at a reception for a group of visiting French tour operators. It gave her a pang to see the photograph of her husband, looking so handsome and distinguished, with herself on his arm smiling up at him. She purchased copies of all the papers and took them on board the British Airways flight. During the flight, she passed the time by writing down in her notebook everything she could remember from what Druid had told her of the man that she was going to find. She headed the page, "Sir Nicholas Quentin Harper, Bart." Druid had told her that Nicholas's great-grandfather had been awarded the title of baronet for his work as a career officer in the British colonial service. For three generations, the family had maintained the strongest of ties with Africa, and especially with the British colonies and spheres of influence in North Africa, Egypt and the Sudan, Uganda and Kenya. According to Druid, Sir Nicholas himself had served in Africa and the Gulf States with the British Army. He was a fluent Arabic and Swahili speaker, and a noted amateur archaeologist and zoologist. Like his father, grandfather and great-grandfather before him, he had made numerous expeditions to North Africa to collect specimens and to explore the more remote regions. He had written a number of articles for various scientific journals and had even lectured at the Royal Geographical Society. When his elder brother died childless, Sir Nicholas had inherited the title and the family estate at Quentin Park. He had resigned from the army to run the estate, but more especially to supervise the family museum that had been started in 1885 by his great-grandfather, the first baronet. It housed one of the largest collections of African fauna in private hands, and its ancient Egyptian and Middle Eastern collection of artifacts was equally famous. However, from Duryea's accounts, she concluded that there must be a wild and even lawless streak in Sir Nicholas's nature. It was obvious that he was not afraid to take some extraordinary risks to add to the collection at Quentin Park. Duryea had first met him a number of years previously, when Sir Nicholas had recruited him to act as an intelligence officer for an illicit expedition to so-called liberate a number of Punic bronze castings from Gaddafi's Libya. Sir Nicholas had sold some of these to defray the expenses of the expedition, but had kept the best of them for his private collection. More recently, there had been another expedition, this time involving an illegal crossing of the Iraqi border to bring out a pair of stone bas-relief friezes from under Saddam Hussein's nose. Duryea had told her that Sir Nicholas had sold one of the pair for a huge amount of money. He had mentioned the sum of $5 million. Duryea had said that he had used the money for the running of the museum, but that the second frieze, the finest of the pair, was still in Sir Nicholas's possession. Both these expeditions had taken place years before Rowan had met Duryea, and she wondered idly at Duryea's readiness to commit himself to the Englishman in this way. Sir Nicholas must have had unique powers of persuasion, for if they had been apprehended in the act, there was no doubt that it would have meant summary execution for both of them. As Duryea had explained to her, on each occasion it was only Nicholas's resourcefulness and his network of friends and admirers across the Middle East and North Africa, which he had been able to call on for help, that had seen them through. "He is a bit of a devil," Duryea had shaken his head with evident nostalgia at the memory. "But the man to have with you when things are tough. Those days were all very exciting, but when I look back on it, I shudder at the risks we took." She had often pondered on the risks that a true in-the-blood collector was prepared to take to slake his passion. The risk seemed to be out of proportion to the reward when it came to adding to his accumulations. And then she smiled at her own pious sentiments. The venture that she hoped to lead Sir Nicholas into was not exactly without risk, and she supposed that a circumlocution of lawyers might debate the legality of it endlessly. Still smiling, she fell asleep, for the strain of these last few days had taken their toll. The air hostess woke her with an admonition to fasten her seatbelt for the landing at Heathrow. Rowan phoned her mother from the airport. "Hello, Mummy, it's me." "Yes, I know that. Where are you, love?" Her mother sounded as unflappable as ever. "At Heathrow. I'm coming up to stay with you for a while. Is that all right?" "Lumley's B&B," her mother chuckled. "I'll go and make your bed. What train will you be coming up on?" "Well, I had a look at the timetable. There's one from King's Cross that'll get me into York at 7 this evening." "I'll meet you at the station." "What happened? Did you and Duryea have a tiff? Old enough to be your father. I said it wouldn't work." Rowan was silent for a moment. This was hardly the time for explanations. I'll tell you about it when I see you this evening." Georgina Lumley, her mother, was waiting on the platform in the gloom and cold of the November evening, bulky and solid in her old green barber coat, with Magic, her cocker spaniel, sitting obediently at her feet. The two of them made an inseparable pair, even when they were not winning field trials cups. For Rowan, they painted a comforting and familiar picture of the English side of her lineage. Georgina kissed Royan's cheek in a perfunctory manner. "Never was one for all that sentimental fiddle-faddle," she often said with satisfaction. And she took one of Royan's bags and led the way to the old mud-splattered Land Rover in the car park. Magic sniffed Royan's hand and wagged his tail in recognition. Then, in a dignified and condescending manner, he allowed her to pat his head. But like his mistress, he was no great sentimentalist either. They drove in silence for a while, and Georgina lit a cigarette. So, what happened to Duryat, then? For a minute, Rohan could not reply. And then the floodgates within her burst, and she let it all come pouring out. It was a 20-minute drive north of York to the little village of Brandsbury, and Rohan talked all the way. Her mother made only small sounds of encouragement and comfort, and when Rohan wept as she related the details of Duryat's death and funeral, Georgina reached across and patted her daughter's hand. It was all over by the time they reached her mother's cottage in the village. Rohan had cried it out and was dry-eyed and rational again, as they ate the dinner that her mother had prepared and left in the oven for them. Rohan could not remember when last she had tasted steak and kidney pie. "So what are you going to do now?" Georgina asked, as she poured what remained of the black bottle of Guinness into her own glass. "To tell the truth, I don't know." As she said it, Rohan wondered ruefully why so many people used that particular phrase to introduce a lie. "I have 6 months' leave from the museum, and Professor Dixon has arranged for me to give a lecture at the university. That is as far as it goes for the moment." "Well," said Georgina, as she stood up, "there's a hot water bottle in your bed, and your room is there for as long as you wish to stay." From her, that was as good as a passionate declaration of maternal love. Over the next few days, Rohan arranged her slides and notes for the lectures, and each afternoon she accompanied Georgina and Magic on their long walks over the surrounding countryside. "Do you know Quentin Park?" she asked her mother during one of these rambles. "Rather," Georgina replied enthusiastically. "Magic and I pick up there 4 or 5 times a season. First-class shoot. Some of the best pheasant and woodcock in Yorkshire. One drive there called the High Larches, which is notorious. Birds so high they baffle the best shots in England." "Do you know the owner, Sir Nicholas Quentin Harper?" Rohan asked. "Seen him at the shoots. Don't know him. Good shot, though," Georgina replied. "Knew his papa in the old days before I married your father." She smiled in a suggestive way that startled Rohan. "Good dancer. We danced a few jigs together, not only on the dance floor." "Mummy, you're outrageous!" Rohan laughed. "Used to be," Georgina agreed readily. "Don't get many opportunities these days." "When are you and Magic going to Quentin Park again?"
2 weeks' time."
"May I come with you?"
"Of course. The keeper is always looking for beaters. 20 quid and lunch with a bottle of beer for the day." She stopped and looked at her daughter quizzically.
"What is all this about, then?"
"I hear there is a private museum on the estate. They have a world-renowned Egyptian collection. I wanted to get a look at it."
"Not open to the public any more. Invitation only. Sir Nicholas is an odd chap, secretive and all that."
"Couldn't you get an invitation for me?" Rohan asked, but Georgina shook her head.
"Why don't you ask Professor Dixon? He's often one of the guns at Quentin Park. Great chum of Quentin Harper."
It was 10 days before Professor Dixon was ready for her. She borrowed her mother's Land Rover and drove to Leeds. The professor folded her in a bear hug and then took her through to his office for tea. It was nostalgic of her days as a student to be back in the cluttered room filled with books and papers and ancient artifacts. Rohan told him about Duryat's murder, and Dixon was shocked and distressed. But she quickly changed the subject to the slides that she had prepared for the lecture. He was fascinated by everything she had to show him. It was almost time for her to leave before she had an opportunity to broach the subject of the Quentin Park Museum, but he responded immediately. "I'm amazed that you never visited it while you were a student here. It's a very impressive collection. The family has been at it for over 100 years. As a matter of fact, I'm shooting on the estate next Thursday. I'll have a word with Nicholas. However, the poor chap isn't up to much at the moment. Last year he suffered a terrible personal tragedy. Lost his wife and 2 little girls in a motor accident on the M1. He shook his head. "Awful business. Nicholas was driving. I think he blames himself." He walked her out to the Land Rover.